Their intercourse is not upon a footing of equality, but it is not constrained. When moneyed aristocracy succeeds to aristocracy of birth, the case is altered. The privileges of some are still extremely great, but the possibility of acquiring those privileges is open to all, whence it follows that those who possess them are constantly haunted by the apprehension of losing them, or of other men's sharing them. Those who do not yet enjoy them long to possess them at any cost, or, if they fail, to appear at least to possess them, which is not impossible. As the social importance of men is no longer ostensibly and permanently fixed by blood, and is infinitely varied by wealth, ranks still exist, but it is not easy clearly to distinguish at a glance those who respectively belong to them. Secret hostilities then arise in the community. One set of men endeavor by innumerable artifices to penetrate, or to appear to penetrate, amongst those who are above them. Another set are constantly in arms against these usurpers of their rights. Or rather, the same individual does both at once, and whilst he seeks to raise himself into a higher circle, he is always on the defensive against the intrusion of those below him. Such is the condition of England at the present time, and I am of opinion that the peculiarity before adverted to is principally to be attributed to this cause. As aristocratic pride is still extremely great amongst the English, and as the limits of aristocracy are ill-defined, everybody lives in constant dread lest advantage should be taken of his familiarity. Unable to judge at once of the social position of those he meets, an Englishman prudently avoids all contact with them. Men are afraid lest some slight service rendered should draw them into an unsuitable acquaintance. They dread civilities, and they avoid the obtrusive gratitude of a stranger quite as much as his hatred. Many people attribute these singular antisocial propensities and the reserved and taciturn bearing of the English to purely physical causes. I may admit that there is something of it in their race, but much more of it is attributable to their social condition, as is proved by the contrast of the Americans. In America, where the privileges of birth never existed and where riches confer no peculiar rights on their possessors, men unacquainted with each other are very ready to frequent the same places and find neither peril nor advantage in the free interchange of their thoughts. If they meet by accident, they neither seek nor avoid intercourse. Their manner is therefore natural, frank, and open. It is easy to see that they hardly expect or apprehend anything from each other, and that they do not care to display any more than to conceal their position in the world. If their demeanor is often cold and serious, it is never haughty or constrained. If they do not converse, it is because they are not in a humor to talk, not because they think it their interest to be silent. In a foreign country, two Americans are at once friends, simply because they are Americans. They are repulsed by no prejudice. They are attracted by their common country. For two Englishmen, the same blood is not enough. They must be brought together by the same rank. The Americans remark this unsociable mood of the English as much as the French do, and they are not less astonished by it. Yet the Americans are connected with England by their origin, their religion, their language, and partially by their manners. They only differ in their social condition. It may therefore be inferred that the reserve of the English proceeds from the constitution of their country, much more than from that of its inhabitants. Chapter 3. Why the Americans show so little sensitiveness in their own country and are so sensitive in Europe. The temper of the Americans is vindictive, like that of all serious and reflecting nations. They hardly ever forget an offense, but it is not easy to offend them. And their resentment is as slow to kindle as it is to abate. In aristocratic communities, where a small number of persons manage everything, the outward intercourse of men is subject to settled conventional rules. Everyone then thinks he knows exactly what marks of respect or of condescension he ought to display, and none are presumed to be ignorant of the science of etiquette. These usages of the first class in society afterwards serve as a model to all the others, besides which each of the latter lays down a code of its own, to which all its members are bound to conform. Thus, the rules of politeness form a complex system of legislation, which it is difficult to be perfectly master of, but from which it is dangerous for anyone to deviate, so that men are constantly exposed involuntarily to inflict or to receive bitter affronts. But as the distinctions of rank are obliterated, as men differing in education and in birth meet and mingle in the same places of resort, it is almost impossible to agree upon the rules of good breeding. As its laws are uncertain, to disobey them is not a crime, even in the eyes of those who know what they are. Men attach more importance to intentions than to forms, and they grow less civil, but at the same time less quarrelsome. There are many little attentions which an American does not care about, but he thinks they are not due to him, or he presumes that they are not known to be due. He therefore either does not perceive a rudeness, or he forgives it. His manners become less courteous, and his character more plain and masculine. The mutual indulgence which the Americans display, and the manly confidence with which they treat each other, also result from another deeper and more general cause, which I have already adverted to in the preceding chapter. In the United States, the distinctions of rank in civil society are slight. In political society, they are null. An American, therefore, does not think himself bound to pay particular attentions to any of his fellow citizens, nor does he require such attentions from them towards himself, as he does not see that it is his interest eagerly to seek the company of his countrymen. He is slow to fancy that his own company is declined. Despising no one on account of his station, he does not imagine that anyone can despise him for that cause. And until he has clearly perceived an insult, he does not suppose that an affront was intended. The social condition of the Americans naturally accustoms them not to take offense in small matters. And, on the other hand, the democratic freedom which they enjoy transfuses this same mildness of temper into the character of the nation. The political institutions of the United States constantly bring citizens of all ranks into contact and compel them to pursue great undertakings in concert. People thus engaged have scarcely time to attend to the details of etiquette, and they are besides too strongly interested in living harmoniously for them to stick at such things. They therefore soon acquire a habit of considering the feelings and opinions of those whom they meet more than their manners, and they do not allow themselves to be annoyed by trifles. I have often remarked in the United States that it is not easy to make a man understand that his presence may be dispensed with. Hints will not always suffice to shake him off. I contradict an American at every word he says to show him that his conversation bores me. He instantly labors with fresh pertinacity to convince me. I preserve a dogged silence, and he thinks I am meditating deeply on the truths which he is uttering. At last I rush from his company, and he supposes that some urgent business hurries me elsewhere. This man will never understand that he wearies me to extinction unless I tell him so, and the only way to get rid of him is to make him my enemy for life. It appears surprising at first that the same man transported to Europe suddenly becomes so sensitive and captious that I often find it as difficult to avoid offending him here as it was to put him out of countenance. These two opposite effects proceed from the same cause. Democratic institutions generally give men a lofty notion of their country and of themselves. An American leaves his country with a heart swollen with pride. On arriving in Europe, he at once finds out that we are not so engrossed by the United States and the great people which inhabits them as he had supposed, and this begins to annoy him. He has been informed that the conditions of society are not equal in our part of the globe, and he observes that among the nations of Europe, the traces of rank are not wholly obliterated, that wealth and birth still retain some indeterminate privileges, which force themselves upon his notice whilst they elude definition. He is therefore profoundly ignorant of the place which he ought to occupy in this half-ruined scale of classes, which are sufficiently distinct to hate and despise each other, yet sufficiently alike for him to be always confounding them. He is afraid of ranging himself too high. Still more is he afraid of being ranged too low. This twofold peril keeps his mind constantly on the stretch, and embarrasses all he says and does. He learns from tradition that in Europe, ceremonial observances were infinitely varied according to different ranks. This recollection of former times completes his perplexity, and he is the more afraid of not obtaining those marks of respect which are due to him, as he does not exactly know in what they consist. He is like a man surrounded by traps. Society is not a recreation for him, but a serious toil. He weighs your least actions, interrogates your looks, and scrutinizes all you say, lest there should be some hidden allusion to affront him. I doubt whether there was ever a provincial man of quality so punctilious in breeding as he is. He endeavors to attend to the slightest rules of etiquette, and does not allow one of them to be waived towards himself. He is full of scruples, and at the same time, of pretensions. He wishes to do enough, but fears to do too much, and as he does not very well know the limits of the one or of the other, he keeps up a haughty and embarrassed air of reserve. But this is not all. Here is yet another double of the human heart. An American is forever talking of the admirable equality which prevails in the United States. Aloud, he makes it the boast of his country, but in secret he deplores it for himself, and he aspires to show that, for his part, he is an exception to the general state of things which he vaunts. There is hardly an American to be met with who does not claim some remote kindred with the first founders of the colonies. And as for the scions of the noble families of England, America seemed to me to be covered with them. When an opulent American arrives in Europe, his first care is to surround himself with all the luxuries of wealth. He is so afraid of being taken for the plain citizen of a democracy that he adopts 100 distorted ways of bringing some new instance of his wealth before you every day. His house will be in the most fashionable part of the town. He will always be surrounded by a host of servants. I have heard an American complain that in the best houses of Paris the society was rather mixed. The taste which prevails there was not pure enough for him, and he ventured to hint that, in his opinion, there was a want of elegance of manner. He could not accustom himself to see wit concealed under such unpretending forms. These contrasts ought not to surprise us. If the vestiges of former aristocratic distinctions were not so completely effaced in the United States, the Americans would be less simple and less tolerant in their own country. They would require less, and be less fond of borrowed manners in ours. Chapter 4. Consequences of the three preceding chapters. When men feel a natural compassion for their mutual sufferings, when they are brought together by easy and frequent intercourse and no sensitive feelings keep them asunder, it may readily be supposed that they will lend assistance to one another whenever it is needed. When an American asks for the cooperation of his fellow citizens, it is seldom refused, and I have often seen it afforded spontaneously and with great goodwill. If an accident happens on the highway, everybody hastens to help the sufferer. If some great and sudden calamity befalls a family, the purses of 1,000 strangers are at once willingly opened, and small but numerous donations pour in to relieve their distress. It often happens that amongst the most civilized nations of the globe, that a poor wretch is as friendless in the midst of a crowd as the savage in his wilds. This is hardly ever the case in the United States. The Americans, who are always cold and often coarse in their manners, seldom show insensibility, and if they do not proffer services eagerly, yet they do not refuse to render them. All this is not in contradiction to what I have said before on the subject of individualism. The two things are so far from combating each other that I can see how they agree. Equality of conditions, whilst it makes men feel their independence, shows them their own weakness. They are free, but exposed to 1,000 accidents. And experience soon teaches them that, although they do not habitually require the assistance of others, a time almost always comes when they cannot do without it. We constantly see in Europe that men of the same profession are ever ready to assist each other. They are all exposed to the same ills, and that is enough to teach them to seek mutual preservatives, however hard-hearted and selfish they may otherwise be. When one of them falls into danger from which the others may save him by a slight transient sacrifice or a sudden effort, they do not fail to make the attempt. Not that they are deeply interested in his fate, For if by chance their exertions are unavailing, they immediately forget the object of them and return to their own business. But a sort of tacit and almost involuntary agreement has been passed between them, by which each one owes to the others a temporary support which he may claim for himself in turn. Extend to a people the remark here applied to a class, and you will understand my meaning. A similar covenant exists, in fact, between all the citizens of a democracy. They all feel themselves subject to the same weakness and the same dangers. And their interest, as well as their sympathy, makes it a rule with them to lend each other mutual assistance when required. The more equal social conditions become, the more do men display this reciprocal disposition to oblige each other. In democracies, no great benefits are conferred, but good offices are constantly rendered. A man seldom displays self-devotion, but all men are ready to be of service to one another. Chapter 5. How Democracy Affects the Relation of Masters and Servants. An American who had traveled for a long time in Europe once said to me, "The English treat their servants with a stiffness and imperiousness of manner which surprise us. But on the other hand, the French sometimes treat their attendants with a degree of familiarity or of politeness which we cannot conceive. It looks as if they were afraid to give orders. The posture of the superior and the inferior is ill-maintained." The remark was a just one, and I have often made it myself. I have always considered England as the country in the world where, in our time, the bond of domestic service is drawn most tightly, and France as the country where it is most relaxed. Nowhere have I seen masters stand so high or so low as in these two countries. Between these two extremes, the Americans are to be placed. Such is the fact as it appears upon the surface of things. To discover the causes of that fact, it is necessary to search the matter thoroughly. No communities have ever yet existed in which social conditions have been so equal that there were neither rich nor poor, and consequently neither masters nor servants. Democracy does not prevent the existence of these two classes, but it changes their dispositions and modifies their mutual relations. Amongst aristocratic nations, servants form a distinct class, not more variously composed than that of masters. A settled order is soon established. In the former, as well as in the latter class, a scale is formed, with numerous distinctions or marked gradations of rank, and generations succeed each other thus without any change of position. These two communities are superposed one above the other, always distinct, but regulated by analogous principles. The aristocratic constitution does not exert a less powerful influence on the notions and manners of servants than on those of masters. And, although the effects are different, the same cause may be easily traced. Both classes constitute small communities in the heart of the nation, and certain permanent notions of right and wrong are ultimately engendered amongst them. The different acts of human life are viewed by one particular and unchanging light. In the society of servants, as in that of masters, men exercise a great influence over each other. They acknowledge settled rules, and in the absence of law, they are guided by a sort of public opinion. Their habits are settled, and their conduct is placed under a certain control. These men, whose destiny is to obey, certainly do not understand fame, virtue, honesty, and honor in the same manner as their masters. But they have a pride, a virtue, and an honesty pertaining to their condition, and they have a notion, if I may use the expression, of a sort of servile honor. Author's note: if the principal opinions by which men are guided are examined closely and in detail, the analogy appears still more striking, and one is surprised to find amongst them, just as much as amongst the haughtiest scions of a feudal race, pride of birth, respect for their ancestry and their descendants, disdain of their inferiors, a dread of contact, a taste for etiquette, precedence, and antiquity. Because a class is mean, it must not be supposed that all who belong to it are mean-hearted. To think so would be a great mistake. However lowly it may be, he who is foremost there, and who has no notion of quitting it, occupies an aristocratic position which inspires him with lofty feelings, pride, and self-respect that fit him for the higher virtues and actions above the common. Amongst aristocratic nations, it was by no means rare to find men of noble and vigorous minds in the service of the great, who felt not the servitude they bore, and who submitted to the will of their masters without any fear of their displeasure. But this was hardly ever the case amongst the inferior ranks of domestic servants. It may be imagined that he who occupies the lowest stage of the order of menials stands very low indeed. The French created a word on purpose to designate the servants of the aristocracy. They called them lackeys. This word, lackey, served as the strongest expression, when all others were exhausted, to designate human meanness. Under the old French monarchy, to denote by a single expression a low-spirited, contemptible fellow, it was usual to say that he had the soul of a lackey. The term was enough to convey all that was intended. The permanent inequality of conditions not only gives servants certain peculiar virtues and vices, but it places them in a peculiar relation with respect to their masters. Amongst aristocratic nations, the poor man is familiarized from his childhood with the notion of being commanded. To whichever side he turns his eyes, the graduated structure of society and the aspect of obedience meet his view. Hence, in those countries, the master readily obtains prompt, complete, respectful, and easy obedience from his servants, because they revere in him not only their master, but the class of masters. He weighs down their will by the whole weight of the aristocracy. He orders their actions. To a certain extent, he even directs their thoughts. In aristocracies, the master often exercises, even without being aware of it, an amazing sway over the opinions, the habits, and the manners of those who obey him, and his influence extends even further than his authority. In aristocratic communities, there are not only hereditary families of servants as well as of masters, but the same families of servants adhere for several generations to the same families of masters, like two parallel lines which neither meet nor separate. And this considerably modifies the mutual relations of these two classes of persons. Thus, although in aristocratic society the master and the servant have no natural resemblance, although on the contrary they are placed at an immense distance on the scale of human beings by their fortune, education, and opinions, yet time ultimately binds them together. They are connected by a long series of common reminiscences, and however different they may be, they grow alike. Whilst in democracies, where they are naturally almost alike, they always remain strangers to each other. Amongst an aristocratic people, the master gets to look upon his servants as an inferior and secondary part of himself, and he often takes an interest in their lot by a last stretch of egotism. Servants, on their part, are not averse to regard themselves in the same light, and they sometimes identify themselves with the person of the master, so that they become an appendage to him in their own eyes as well as in his. In aristocracies, a servant fills a subordinate position which he cannot get out of. Above him is another man, holding a superior rank which he cannot lose. On one side are obscurity, poverty, obedience for life. On the other, and also for life, fame, wealth, and command. The two conditions are always distinct and always in propinquity. The tie that connects them is as lasting as they are themselves. In this predicament, the servant ultimately detaches his notion of interest from his own person. He deserts himself, as it were, or rather, he transports himself into the character of his master, and thus assumes an imaginary personality. He complacently invests himself with the wealth of those who command him. He shares their fame, exalts himself by their rank, and feeds his mind with borrowed greatness, to which he attaches more importance than those who fully and really possess it. There is something touching and at the same time ridiculous in this strange confusion of the two states of being. These passions of the masters, when they pass into the souls of menials, assume the natural dimensions of the place they occupy. They are contracted and lowered. What was pride in the former becomes puerile vanity and paltry ostentation in the latter. The servants of a great man are commonly most punctilious as to the marks of respect due to him, and they attach more importance to his slightest privileges than he does himself. In France, a few of these old servants of the aristocracy are still to be met with here and there. They have survived their race, which will soon disappear with them altogether. In the United States, I never saw anyone at all like them. The Americans are not only unacquainted with the kind of man, but it is hardly possible to make them understand that such ever existed. It is scarcely less difficult for them to conceive it than for us to form a correct notion of what a slave was amongst the Romans, or a serf in the Middle Ages. All these men were in fact, though in different degrees, results of the same cause. They are all retiring from our sight and disappearing in the obscurity of the past, together with the social condition to which they owed their origin. Equality of conditions turns servants and masters into new beings and places them in new relative positions. When social conditions are nearly equal, men are constantly changing their situations in life, and there is still a class of menials and a class of masters, but these classes are not always composed of the same individuals, still less of the same families. And those who command are not more secure perpetuity than those who obey. As servants do not form a separate people, they have no habits, prejudices, or manners peculiar to themselves. They are not remarkable for any particular turn of mind or moods of feeling. They know no vices or virtues of their condition, but they partake of the education, the opinions, the feelings, the virtues, and the vices of their contemporaries. And they are honest men or scoundrels in the same way as their masters are. The conditions of servants are not less equal than those of masters. As no marked ranks or fixed subordination are to be found amongst them, they will not display either the meanness or the greatness which characterizes the aristocracy of menials, as well as all other aristocracies. I never saw a man in the United States who reminded me of that class of confidential servants of which we still retain a reminiscence in Europe. Neither did I ever meet with such a thing as a lackey. All traces of the one and of the other have disappeared. In democracies, servants are not only equal amongst themselves, but it may be said that they are in some sort the equals of their masters. This requires explanation in order to be rightly understood. At any moment, a servant may become a master, and he aspires to rise to that condition. The servant is therefore not a different man from the master. Why, then, has the former a right to command, and what compels the latter to obey? The free and temporary consent of both their wills. Neither of them is by nature inferior to the other. They only become so for a time by covenant. Within the terms of this covenant, the one is a servant, the other a master. Beyond it, they are two citizens of the commonwealth, two men. I beg the listener particularly to observe that this is not only the notion which servants themselves entertain of their own condition. Domestic service is looked upon by masters in the same light, and the precise limits of authority and obedience are as clearly settled in the mind of the one as in that of the other. When the greater part of the community have long attained a condition nearly alike, and when equality is an old and acknowledged fact, the public mind, which is never affected by exceptions, assigns certain general limits to the value of man, above or below which no man can long remain placed. It is in vain that wealth and poverty, authority and obedience, accidentally interpose great distances between two men. Public opinion, founded upon the usual order of things, draws them to a common level and creates a species of imaginary equality between them, in spite of the real inequality of their conditions. This all-powerful opinion penetrates at length even into the hearts of those whose interest might arm them to resist it. It affects their judgment, whilst it subdues their will. In their inmost convictions, the master and the servant no longer perceive any deep-seated difference between them, and they neither hope nor fear to meet with any such at any time. They are therefore neither subject to disdain nor to anger, and they discern in each other neither humility nor pride. The master holds the contract of service to be the only source of his power, and the servant regards it as the only cause of his obedience. They do not quarrel about their reciprocal situations, but each knows his own and keeps it. In the French army, The common soldier is taken from nearly the same classes as the officer, and may hold the same commissions. Out of the ranks, he considers himself entirely equal to his military superiors, and in point of fact, he is so. But when under arms, he does not hesitate to obey, and his obedience is not the less prompt, precise, and ready for being voluntary and defined. This example may give a notion of what takes place between masters and servants in democratic communities. It would be preposterous to suppose that those warm and deep-seated affections, which are sometimes kindled in the domestic service of aristocracy, will ever spring up between these two men, or that they will exhibit strong instances of self-sacrifice. In aristocracies, masters and servants live apart, and frequently their only intercourse is through a third person, yet they commonly stand firmly by one another. In democratic countries, the master and the servant are close together, and they are in daily personal contact, but their minds do not intermingle. They have common occupations, hardly ever common interests. Amongst such a people, the servant always considers himself a sojourner in the dwelling of his masters. He knew nothing of their forefathers, he will see nothing of their descendants. He has nothing lasting to expect from their hand. Why, then, should he confound his life with theirs, and whence should so strange a surrender of himself proceed? The reciprocal position of the two men is changed. Their mutual relations must be so too. I would fain illustrate all these reflections by the example of the Americans, but for this purpose the distinctions of persons and places must be accurately traced. In the South of the Union, slavery exists. All that I have just said is consequently inapplicable there. In the North, the majority of servants are either freedmen or the children of freedmen. These persons occupy a contested position in the public estimation. By the laws, they are brought up to the level of their masters. By the manners of the country, they are obstinately detruded from it. They do not themselves clearly know their proper place, and they are almost always either insolent or craven. But in the northern states, especially in New England, there are a certain number of whites who agree for wages to yield a temporary obedience to the will of their fellow citizens. I have heard that these servants commonly perform the duties of their situation with punctuality and intelligence, and that without thinking themselves naturally inferior to the person who orders them, they submit without reluctance to obey him. They appear to me to carry into service some of those manly habits which independence and equality engender. Having once selected a hard way of life, they do not seek to escape from it by indirect means, and they have sufficient respect for themselves not to refuse to their master the obedience which they have freely promised. On their part, masters require nothing of their servants but the faithful and rigorous performance of the covenant. They do not ask for marks of respect. They do not claim their love or devoted attachment. It is enough that, as servants, they are exact and honest. It would not then be true to assert that, in democratic society, the relation of servants and masters is disorganized. It is organized on another footing. The rule is different, but there is a rule. It is not my purpose to inquire whether the new state of things which I have just described is inferior to that which preceded it, or simply different. Enough for me that it is fixed and determined, for what is most important to meet with among men is not any given ordering, but order. But what shall I say of those sad and troubled times at which equality is established in the midst of the tumult of revolution, when democracy, after having been introduced into the state of society, still struggles with difficulty against the prejudices and manners of the country? The laws, and partially public opinion, already declare that no natural or permanent inferiority exists between the servant and the master. But this new belief has not yet reached the innermost convictions of the latter, or rather his heart rejects it. In the secret persuasion of his mind, the master thinks that he belongs to a peculiar and superior race. He dares not say so, but he shudders whilst he allows himself to be dragged to the same level. His authority over his servants becomes timid and at the same time harsh. He has already ceased to entertain for them the feelings of patronizing kindness which long uncontested power always engenders, and he is surprised that, being changed himself, his servant changes also. He wants his attendants to form regular and permanent habits, in a condition of domestic service which is only temporary. He requires that they should appear contented with and proud of a servile condition which they will one day shake off, that they should sacrifice themselves to a man who can neither protect nor ruin them, and in short, that they should contract an indissoluble engagement to a being like themselves, and one who will last no longer than they will. Amongst aristocratic nations, it often happens that the condition of domestic service does not degrade the character of those who enter upon it, because they neither know nor imagine any other. And the amazing inequality which is manifest between them and their master appears to be the necessary and unavoidable consequence of some hidden law of providence. In democracies, the condition of domestic service does not degrade the character of those who enter upon it, because it is freely chosen and adopted for a time only. Because it is not stigmatized by public opinion and creates no permanent inequality between the servant and the master. But whilst the transition from one social condition to another is going on, there is almost always a time when men's minds fluctuate between the aristocratic notion of subjection and the democratic notion of obedience. Obedience, then, loses its moral importance in the eyes of him who obeys. He no longer considers it as a species of divine obligation, and he does not view it under its purely human aspect. It has to him no character of sanctity or of justice, and he submits to it as to a degrading but profitable condition. At that moment, a confused and imperfect phantom of equality haunts the minds of servants. They do not at once perceive whether the equality to which they are entitled is to be found within or without the pale of domestic service, and they rebel in their hearts against the subordination to which they have subjected themselves and from which they derive actual profit. They consent to serve, and they blush to obey. They like the advantages of service, but not the master. Or rather, they are not sure that they ought not themselves to be masters, and that they are inclined to consider him who orders them as an unjust usurper of their own rights. Then it is that the dwelling of every citizen offers a spectacle somewhat analogous to the gloomy aspect of political society. A secret and intestine warfare is going on there between powers, ever rivals and suspicious of one another. The master is ill-natured and weak, the servant ill-natured and intractable. The one constantly attempts to evade by unfair restrictions his obligation to protect and to remunerate, the other his obligation to obey. The reins of domestic government dangle between them, to be snatched by one or the other. The lines which divide authority from oppression, liberty from license, and right from might, are to their eyes so jumbled together and confused that no one knows exactly what he is or what he may be or what he ought to be. Such condition is not democracy, but revolution. Chapter 6. That democratic institutions and manners tend to raise rents and shorten the terms of leases. What has been said of servants and masters is applicable, to a certain extent, to landowners and farming tenants, but this subject deserves to be considered by itself. In America, there are, properly speaking, no tenant farmers. Every man owns the ground he tills. It must be admitted that democratic laws tend greatly to increase the number of landowners and to diminish that of farming tenants. Yet what takes place in the United States is much less attributable to the institutions of the country than to the country itself. In America, land is cheap, and anyone may easily become a landowner. Its returns are small, and its produce cannot be divided between a landowner and a farmer. America, therefore, stands alone in this as well as in many other respects, and it would be a mistake to take it as an example. I believe that in democratic as well as in aristocratic countries, there will be landowners and tenants, but the connection existing between them will be of a different kind. In aristocracies, the hire of a farm is paid to the landlord, not only in rent, but in respect, regard, and duty. In democracies, the whole is paid in cash. When estates are divided and passed from hand to hand, and the permanent connection which existed between families and the soil is dissolved, the landowner and the tenant are only casually brought into contact. They meet for a moment to settle the conditions of the agreement, and then lose sight of each other. They are two strangers brought together by a common interest and who keenly talk over a matter of business, the sole object of which is to make money. In proportion as property is subdivided and wealth distributed over the country, the community is filled with people whose former opulence is declining and with others whose fortunes are of recent growth and whose wants increase more rapidly than their resources. For all such persons, the smallest pecuniary profit is a matter of importance, and none of them feel disposed to waive any of their claims or to lose any portion of their income. As ranks are intermingled, and as very large as well as very scanty fortunes become more rare, every day brings the social condition of the landowner nearer to that of the farmer. The one has not naturally any uncontested superiority over the other. Between two men who are equal, and not at ease in their circumstances, the contract of hire is exclusively an affair of money. A man whose estate extends over a whole district, and who owns 100 farms, is well aware of the importance of gaining at the same time the affections of some thousands of men. This object appears to call for his exertions, and to attain it, he will readily make considerable sacrifices. But he who owns 100 acres is insensible to similar considerations, and he cares but little to win the private regard of his tenant. An aristocracy does not expire like a man in a single day. The aristocratic principle is slowly undermined in men's opinion before it is attacked in their laws. Long before open war is declared against it, the tie which had hitherto united the higher classes to the lower may be seen to be gradually relaxed. Indifference and contempt are betrayed by one class, jealousy and hatred by the others. The intercourse between rich and poor becomes less frequent and less kind, and rents are raised. This is not the consequence of a democratic revolution, but its certain harbinger. For an aristocracy which has lost the affections of the people once and forever is like a tree dead at the root, which is the more easily torn up by the winds the higher its branches have spread. In the course of the last 50 years, the rents of farms have amazingly increased, not only in France but throughout the greater part of Europe. The remarkable improvements which have taken place in agriculture and manufactures within the same period do not suffice, in my opinion, to explain this fact. Recourse must be had to another cause more powerful and more concealed. I believe that the cause is to be found in the democratic institutions in which several European nations have adopted, and in the democratic passions which more or less agitate all the rest. I have frequently heard great English landowners congratulate themselves that, at the present day, they derive a much larger income from their estates than their fathers did. They have perhaps good reasons to be glad, but most assuredly they know not what they are glad of. They think they are making a clear gain, when it is in reality only an exchange. Their influence is what they are parting with for cash, and what they gain in money will ere long be lost in power. There is yet another sign by which it is easy to know that a great democratic revolution is going on or approaching. In the Middle Ages, almost all lands were leased for lives, or for very long terms. The domestic economy of that period shows that leases for 99 years were more frequent than leases for 12 years are now. Men then believed that families were immortal. Men's conditions seemed settled forever, and the whole of society appeared to be so fixed that it was not supposed that anything would ever be stirred or shaken in its structure. In ages of equality, the human mind takes a different bent. The prevailing notion is that nothing abides, and man is haunted by the thought of mutability. Under this impression, the landowner and the tenant himself are instinctively averse to protracted terms of obligation. They are afraid of being tied up tomorrow by the contract which benefits them today. They have vague anticipations of some sudden and unforeseen change in their conditions. They mistrust themselves. They fear lest their taste should change, and lest they should lament that they cannot rid themselves of what they coveted. Nor are such fears unfounded, for in democratic ages, that which is most fluctuating amidst the fluctuation of all around is the heart of man. Chapter 7. Influence of Democracy on Wages. Most of the remarks which I have already made in speaking of servants and masters may be applied to masters and workmen. As the gradations of the social scale come to be less observed, whilst the great sink, the humble rise, and as poverty as well as opulence ceases to be hereditary, the distance, both in reality and in opinion, which heretofore separated the workman from the master, is lessened every day. The workman conceives a more lofty opinion of his rights, of his future, of himself. He is filled with new ambition and with new desires. He is harassed by new wants. Every instant he views with longing eyes the profits of his employer, and in order to share them, he strives to dispose of his labor at a higher rate, and he generally succeeds at length in the attempt. In democratic countries, as well as elsewhere, most of the branches of productive industry are carried on at a small cost by men little removed by their wealth or education above the level of those whom they employ. These manufacturing speculators are extremely numerous. Their interests differ. They cannot therefore easily concert or combine their exertions. On the other hand, the workmen have almost always some sure resources which enable them to refuse to work when they cannot get what they conceive to be the fair price of their labor. In the constant struggle for wages which is going on between these two classes, their strength is divided, and success alternates from one to the other. It is even probable that in the end the interest of the working class must prevail, for the high wages which they have already obtained make them every day less dependent on their masters. And as they grow more independent, they have greater facilities for obtaining a future increase of wages. I shall take, for example, that branch of productive industry which is still at the present day the most generally followed in France and in almost all the countries of the world. I mean the cultivation of the soil. In France, most of those who labor for hire in agriculture are themselves owners of certain plots of ground, which just enable them to subsist without working for anyone else. When these laborers come to offer their services to a neighboring landowner or farmer, if he refuses them a certain rate of wages, they retire to their own small property and await another opportunity. I think that upon the whole, it may be asserted that a slow and gradual rise of wages is one of the general laws of democratic communities. In proportion, as social conditions become more equal, wages rise, and as wages are higher, social conditions become more equal. But a great and gloomy exception occurs in our own time. I have shown in a preceding chapter that aristocracy, expelled from political society, has taken refuge in certain departments of productive industry and has established its sway there under another form. This powerfully affects the rate of wages. As a large capital is required to embark in the great manufacturing speculations to which I allude, the number of persons who enter upon them is exceedingly limited. As their number is small, they can easily concert together and fix the rate of wages as they please. Their workmen, on the contrary, are exceedingly numerous, and the number of them is always increasing. For, from time to time, an extraordinary run of business takes place, during which wages are inordinately high, and they attract the surrounding population to the factories. But, when once men have embraced that line of life, we have already seen that they cannot quit it again, because they soon contract habits of body and mind which unfit them for any other sort of toil. These men have generally but little education and industry, but with few resources, they stand therefore almost at the mercy of the master. When competition or other fortuitous circumstances lessen his profits, he can reduce the wages of his workmen almost at pleasure, and make from them what he loses by the chances of business. Should the workmen strike, the master, who is a rich man, can very well wait without being ruined until necessity brings them back to him. But they must work day by day, or they die, for their only property is in their hands. They have long been impoverished by oppression, and the poorer they become, the more easily may they be oppressed. They can never escape from this fatal circle of cause and consequence. It is not then surprising that wages, after having sometime suddenly risen, are permanently lowered in this branch of industry. Whereas in other callings the price of labor, which generally increases but little, is nevertheless constantly augmented. This state of dependence and wretchedness, in which a part of the manufacturing population of our time lives, forms an exception to the general rule, contrary to the state of all the rest of the community. But, for this very reason, no circumstance is more important or more deserving of the especial consideration of the legislator, for when the whole of society is in motion, it is difficult to keep any one class stationary. And when the greater number of men are opening new paths to fortune, it is no less difficult to make the few support in peace their wants and their desires. Chapter 8. Influence of Democracy on Kindred. I have just examined the changes which the equality of conditions produces in the mutual relations of the several members of the community amongst democratic nations, and amongst the Americans in particular. I would now go deeper and inquire into the closer ties of kindred. My object here is not to seek for new truths, but to show in what manner facts already known are connected with my subject. It has been universally remarked that in our time, the several members of a family stand upon an entirely new footing towards each other, that the distance which formerly separated a father from his sons has been lessened, and that paternal authority, if not destroyed, is at least impaired. Something analogous to this, but even more striking, may be observed in the United States. In America, the family, in the Roman and aristocratic signification of the word, does not exist. All that remains of it are a few vestiges of the first years of childhood, when the father exercises, without opposition, that absolute domestic authority, which the feebleness of his children renders necessary, and which their interest, as well as his own incontestable superiority, warrants. But as soon as the young American approaches manhood, the ties of filial obedience are relaxed day by day. Master of his thoughts, he is soon master of his conduct. In America, there is, strictly speaking, no adolescence. At the close of boyhood, the man appears and begins to trace out his own path. It would be an error to suppose that this is preceded by a domestic struggle, in which the son has obtained by a sort of moral violence the liberty that his father refused him. The same habits, the same principles which impel the one to assert his independence, predispose the other to consider the use of that independence as an incontestable right. The former does not exhibit any of those rancorous or irregular passions which disturb men long after they have shaken off an established authority. The latter feels none of that bitter and angry regret which is apt to survive a bygone power. The father foresees the limits of his authority long beforehand, and when the time arrives he surrenders it without struggle. The son looks forward to the exact period at which he will be his own master, and he enters upon his freedom without precipitation and without effort, as a possession which is his own and which no one seeks to wrest from him. Author's note: the Americans, however, have not yet thought fit to strip the parent, as has been done in France, of one of the chief elements of parental authority, by depriving him of the power of disposing of his property at his death. In the United States, there are no restrictions on the powers of a testator. In this respect, as in almost all others, it is easy to perceive that if the political legislation of the Americans is much more democratic than that of the French, the civil legislation of the latter is infinitely more democratic than that of the former. This may easily be accounted for. The civil legislation of France was the work of a man who saw that it was his interest to satisfy the democratic passions of his contemporaries in all that was not directly and immediately hostile to his own power. He was willing to allow some popular principles to regulate the distribution of property and the government of families, provided they were not to be introduced into administration of public affairs. Whilst the torrent of democracy overwhelmed the civil laws of the country, he hoped to find an easy shelter behind its political institutions. This policy was at once both adroit and selfish, but a compromise of this kind could not last, for in the end, political institutions never fail to become the image and expression of civil society. And in this sense, it may be said that nothing is more political in a nation than its civil legislation. It may perhaps not be without utility to show how these changes which take place in family relations are closely connected with the social and political revolution which is approaching its consummation under our own observation. There are certain great social principles which a people either introduces everywhere or tolerates nowhere. In countries which are aristocratically constituted with all the gradations of rank, the government never makes a direct appeal to the mass of the governed. As men are united together, it is enough to lead the foremost. The rest will follow. This is equally applicable to the family, as to all aristocracies which have a head. Amongst aristocratic nations, social institutions recognize in truth no one in the family but the father. Children are received by society at his hands. Society governs him, he governs them. Thus the parent has not only a natural right, but he acquires a political right to command them. He is the author and the support of his family. But he is also its constituted ruler. In democracies, where the government picks out every individual singly from the mass, to make him subservient to the general laws of the community, no such intermediate person is required. A father is there, in the eye of the law, only a member of the community, older and richer than his sons. When most of the conditions of life are extremely unequal, and the inequality of these conditions is permanent, the notion of a superior grows upon the imaginations of men. If the law invested him with no privileges, custom and public opinion would concede them. When, on the contrary, men differ but little from each other and do not always remain in dissimilar conditions of life, the general notion of a superior becomes weaker and less distinct. It is vain for legislation to strive to place him who obeys very much beneath him who commands. The manners of the time bring the two men nearer to one another and draw them daily towards the same level. Although the legislation of an aristocratic people should grant no peculiar privileges to the heads of families, I shall not be the less convinced that their power is more respected and more extensive than in a democracy. For I know that, whatsoever the laws may be, superiors always appear higher and inferiors lower in aristocracies than amongst democratic nations. When men live more for the remembrance of what has been than for the care of what is, and when they are more given to attend to what their ancestors thought than to think themselves, the father is the natural and necessary tie between the past and the present, the link by which the ends of these two chains are connected. In aristocracies, then, the father is not only the civil head of the family, but the oracle of its traditions, the expounder of its customs, the arbiter of its manners. He is listened to with deference, he is addressed with respect, and the love which is felt for him is always tempered with fear. When the condition of society becomes democratic, and men adopt as their general principle that it is good and lawful to judge of all things for oneself, using former points of belief not as a rule of faith, but simply as a means of information, the power which the opinions of a father exercise over those of his sons diminishes as well as his legal power. Perhaps the subdivision of estates which democracy brings with it contributes more than anything else to change the relations existing between a father and his children. When the property of a father of a family is scanty, his son and himself constantly live in the same place and share the same occupations. Habit and necessity bring them together and force them to hold constant communication. The inevitable consequence is a sort of familiar intimacy which renders authority less absolute and which can ill be reconciled with the external forms of respect. Now in democratic countries, the class of those who are possessed of small fortunes is precisely that which gives strength to the notions and a particular direction to the manners of the community. That class makes its opinions preponderate as universally as its will, and even those who are most inclined to resist its commands are carried away in the end by its example. I have known eager opponents of democracy who allowed their children to address them with perfect colloquial equality. Thus, at the same time that the power of aristocracy is declining, the austere, the conventional, and the legal part of parental authority vanishes, and a species of equality prevails around the domestic hearth. I know not, upon the whole, whether society loses by the change, but I am inclined to believe that man individually is a gainer by it. I think that, in proportion as manners and laws become more democratic, the relation of father and son becomes more intimate and more affectionate. Rules and authority are less talked of. Confidence and tenderness are oftentimes increased, and it would seem that the natural bond is drawn closer in proportion as the social bond is loosened. In a democratic family, the father exercises no other power than that with which men love to invest the affection and the experience of age. His orders would perhaps be disobeyed, but his advice is, for the most part, authoritative. Though he be not hedged in with ceremonial respect, his sons at least accost him with confidence. No settled form of speech is appropriated to the mode of addressing him, but they speak to him constantly and are ready to consult him day by day. The master and the constituted ruler have vanished. The father remains. Nothing more is needed in order to judge of the difference between the two states of society in this respect than to peruse the family correspondence of aristocratic ages. The style is always correct, ceremonious, stiff, and so cold that the natural warmth of the heart can hardly be felt in the language. The language, on the contrary, addressed by a son to his father in democratic countries is always marked by mingled freedom, familiarity, and affection, which at once show that new relations have sprung up in the bosom of the family. A similar revolution takes place in the mutual relations of children. In aristocratic families, as well as in aristocratic society, every place is marked out beforehand. Not only does the father occupy a separate rank in which he enjoys extensive privileges, but even the children are not equal amongst themselves. The age and sex of each irrevocably determine his rank and secure to him certain privileges. Most of these distinctions are abolished or diminished by democracy. In aristocratic families, the eldest son, inheriting the greater part of the property and most all the rights of the family, becomes the chief and, to a certain extent, the master of his brothers. Greatness and power are for him, for them, mediocrity and dependence. Nevertheless, it would be wrong to suppose that, amongst aristocratic nations, the privileges of the eldest son are advantageous to himself alone, or that they excite nothing but envy and hatred in those around him. The eldest son commonly endeavors to procure wealth and power for his brothers, because the general splendor of the house is reflected back on him who represents it. The younger sons seek to back the elder brother in all his undertakings, because the greatness and power of the head of the family better enable him to provide for all its branches. The different members of an aristocratic family are therefore very closely bound together. Their interests are connected, their minds agree, but their hearts are seldom in harmony. Democracy also binds brothers to each other, but by very different means. Under democratic laws, all the children are perfectly equal and consequently independent. Nothing brings them forcibly together, but nothing keeps them apart. And as they have the same origin, as they are trained under the same roof, as they are treated with the same care, and as no peculiar privilege distinguishes or divides them, the affectionate and youthful intimacy of early years easily springs up between them. Scarcely any opportunities occur to break the tie thus formed at the outset of life, for their brotherhood brings them daily together without embarrassing them. It is not then by interest, but by common associations and by the free sympathy of opinion and of taste, that democracy unites brothers to each other. It divides their inheritance, but it allows their hearts and minds to mingle together. Such is the charm of these democratic manners that even the partisans of aristocracy are caught by it, and after having experienced it for some time, they are by no means tempted to revert to the respectful and frigid observance of aristocratic families. They would be